You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Chelsea Sullenberger III was 57 years old when, in January 2009, he saved the life of every passenger on a U.S. Airways flight by gliding his plane onto the Hudson River. His quick thinking serves as an example of why we might need to reconsider cultural myths about how our brains slow down as we age. This emerging science is the subject of Barbara Strauch's latest book, The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain, The Surprising Talents of the Middle-Aged Brain. It's published by Viking, and I'm very pleased that it brings Ms. Strauch, who is the deputy science editor and health and medical editor at the New York Times, to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
I've always heard that the brain is at its peak when we're in our early 20s, and that's when the great theoretical scientists do their most important work.
There is that thought out there, and I think we all kind of buy into that. But, I'm not quite sure all that's true for most of us. And a lot of that thought comes from some math discoveries, Newton, whatever, and
Einstein did pretty good work when he was young.
Yeah, when he was young. But who knows what those guys would be doing now. I mean, we're entering our new middle age. We're very healthy. And if they were alive now, maybe they'd be doing fine.
On the other hand, wisdom has always been attributed to the age. You say neuroscience and psychology are discrediting all sorts of myths about middle age. Like what?
Midlife crisis, number one. Empty nest syndrome, number two. Those are some, I think, are the fact that, as you talk about, that the best brains are in our 20s, number three. I think that this new modern age is brand new for the human species. We've never had this long stretch. So I think that even the scientists looking into it says it's almost like looking into astrophysicists. Everything they find is new.
At the same time that you say the brain is getting smarter, it's also the brain that's more prone to forgetting where it put the house keys or the name of someone it met at dinner just the night before.
Right. This is so scary, and I think many of us are scary, a little bit freaking out, you might say, when we're looking for our glasses and there they are on top of our heads. You know, we go to the store, we don't know why we went there, and so,
we
yes.
We say senior moment.
Senior moment, they say, and which isn't actually a very nice term when you think of it. But they do find that this kind of forgetting and more easily distractedness does increase in middle age. I think we have to be honest about it. It does.
Well, could it just be, as some people like to joke, information overload? There's no more room to store knowledge as we get older, or we just have so much stuff there it takes a little longer to retrieve everything?
Well, there's that. Our brains are stuffed. We're doing a lot by middle age and learning new things all the time. But I think that explanation is no longer considered sufficient. As they've actually looked at brains as they enter middle age, there are some declines.
So what are we talking about here? Your subtitle says that there are surprising talents of the middle-aged brain. So as we're going to decline, we're also developing other things?
We are. This short-term memory has some, it can get a little dicey, but they now know that memory is not one thing, different things. We remember autobiographical stuff. I have a brother in Phoenix. I remember that. We know how to hit a tennis ball, etc. So they're zeroing in on what stays strong and what doesn't. And even more encouragingly, they now have these long-term studies of real people, 50 years of data now of the same people they've studied, and they're telling us completely different things about middle-aged mind.
Well, I know I've learned an awful lot through experience, things that I couldn't have known when I was younger. Maybe I will forget somebody's name, but I will remember the sad lessons of life.
Right. Experience, I think, is something that we've all kind of used as a cliched word, really. You know, chalk it up to experience. But the scientists now are getting in there and finding out what is experience, breaking it into its component parts. You know, what is it that made that pilot make the right call and land into the Hudson? And it wasn't just him. It was there were all sorts of, like, tugboat captains and everybody else, most of them middle age. The whole crew was what they call senior. And something made them do the right thing.
So what are we calling middle-aged?
Well, now the modern middle age is what they consider maybe 40 to 65. This is a span of time that you're no longer young. You're not yet rolling down those corridors in wheelchairs. So this is the middle. And as a species, we've never had that long time.
So over 65, we go into serious decline?
No. Well, it's a moving target, I would say, middle age, because as our lifespans expand at the turn of the century, they were 48 on average, and now they're on average 80. And so middle age is a little bit of a moving target.
And then we know these people in their 90s who we say are sharp as a tack.
Right, they have, and there's enough of them now that they're studying them. They call them, the scientists call them pristine agers, which is a nice term.
Well, is the middle-aged brain the same as the middle-aged heart or other parts of the body?
Well, yes, exactly. And you've sort of hit the nail on the head. They used to think that the brain was protected from, it is protected from a lot of infections and things. And so people thought that it was protected from good things as well. But now they think the brain is much more like the heart, and things we think of to do for our hearts, we should do for our brains.
Mike, have I been pronouncing your last name right?
Strauch.
Barbara Strauch, whose latest book is The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain, The Surprising Talents of the Middle-Aged Mind. It's published by Viking. That was an example of forgetting things. I've known you in the past,
and I probably asked
how to pronounce your name in the past.
Right. Who are you?
Your previous book was about the teenage brain.
Right.
In fact, we talked about that on the show. Do you ever find that you're making generalizations when really there's a wide range of brain capabilities among different people at various points in their lives?
Well, true enough. There's nothing more varied than the brain. And so when we're talking about what we find out about the brain, we're talking about averages, large population studies. And but now, you know, they're looking into individual brains with brain scanners, and they're watching things happen. So it's not just these big, giant studies of thousands of people. They're watching things happen in individual brains, and I think that's sort of adding to what we know.
Is there a range of differences between brains at different stages?
Yes, there's a spectrum, of course. You know, some people are going to be suffering in middle age more than others. They now think that middle age is much more, our brains are on the cusp, really. What we do in middle age may very well affect how we enter old age. And there's more variability in middle age in brains than in any other time of our life.
So what are some of the new discoveries in science that have had an effect on the way we now view the brain?
Well, I think, number one, these large studies have found, as they follow these people through, for instance, encouragingly, that there's whole bunches of areas where we're better in middle age, and including things like reasoning, including things like getting the gist of an argument, and sort of sizing up a situation. And I think even social expertise, you know, sorting out the good guy from the bad guy, and our brains simply get better and better at that, and it peaks in middle age.
Are these findings that age leads to wisdom and increased mental capabilities in some levels a matter of science catching up to what most cultures have known for millennia?
Many cultures, maybe not our own.
Because in most cultures, people go to the elders for advice.
Yes, and of course, we don't let people be president until they're at least 35. And I think we also look to people to be judges and lawyers and Supreme Court justices and things at a certain age. But we're schizophrenic in this culture. At the same time, we just went through a recession where we were kicking out a lot of 60 and 70-year-old brains who were quite vibrant. So on the one hand, we revere youth. On the other hand, we look to our elders. So we kind of don't know what we're doing here.
Are there scientific experiments that are being designed now that allow us to understand this better? I'm thinking about the technologies you mentioned, brain scans and the like.
Right.
How much can they really tell us?
Well, that technology, of course, when it first came on the scene, was kind of silly in a way. You know, they'd say, well, this part lights up when you say fruits and things like that. And over the last 10 years, I think, maybe 15, they've gotten a lot better. And so when they actually do brain scans now, they have a baseline of what's normal. So they can put people into brain scanners and watch different parts of their brain light up and see at different ages, you know, what's supposed to be happening. They can measure brain volume. For instance, after exercise, brain volume increases. And then they'll test the people and find out that their cognitive scores have also increased. So the regular experiments are being buttressed by a much more sophisticated ability to look inside the brain.
What kinds of exercises are you talking about that will increase brain volume?
Walking fast, anything aerobic, really. Again, I think we kind of know this, but again, what we do for our heart is we need the brain, like everything else, needs oxygen. And whatever we can do to get oxygen up there to our brain cells is a good thing.
So couch potato is a bad idea.
It is still a bad idea for our brains.
When did the notion that the middle-aged brain becomes diminished, declining, and depressed, as you say, become the conventional wisdom?
Well, I think the scientists, for one thing, for many years thought that we lost. There was scientific dogma based on some random autopsies that we lost 30% of our brain cells as we aged. And that was so depressing that many scientists didn't even bother looking at the middle-aged brain. Why bother with something that's on this inevitable decline? And now, again, with more sophisticated tools, they've looked inside our brains and found out we don't. There's some shrinkage, but we keep most of our brain cells. So that means that you don't have to bring a dead brain cell back to life. You can just kind of tweak it and perhaps keep it going better. So that was, number one, the most encouraging thing, I think, that they found about the physical brain. And so, you know, and a lot of stuff is just not true. The midlife crisis, you know, as they look into these studies, you know, the empty nest syndrome and stuff, as they study these populations of people in our modern middle age, all of that is kind of going out the window.
Well, we still are developing new brain cells, aren't we? In the past, didn't we think that that all stopped at a certain age?
Right. That, too, was not supposed to happen in a grown-up brain. And now, again, with the tools that they've looked at in animals and also humans, they find that the grown-up brain, again, with exercise, is developing baby brain cells. And it's not just random. It's in the part of our brain that is the hippocampus that we use to form memories. So that's encouraging. And they're trying to figure out, you know, what are they doing there? What do we use them for?
They do, but we don't know yet.
We don't quite know yet. There's some people who think they help us connect the old with the new and put it in context, what we're learning in the new world, and may even help us stave off depression. But, you know, this is new science. They don't quite know.
Baby boomers are credited or blamed for so many things. It's my sense that the reason neuroscientists are now more interested in this is because they're baby boomers themselves.
Yeah, right,
and they're tired of being told that they're in serious decline.
It's all about me. Right, exactly. And I think that there is that. And, you know, but I think this is more than just sort of baby boomers patting themselves on the back yet again. Actually, the tools and the science are pretty clear. And what we need to think about is the fact that middle age is not what many of us thought it might be. Many of us grew up, you know, reading John Updike and Gail Sheehy in her early books. And I myself thought, you know, I better get everything done in my 20s, you know, see everything, go everywhere, do everything, because by middle age it would be all over. And I'm not sure any of us are buying into that now.
Are these findings about aging brains true for animals as well? Because I'm assuming that some of the experiments in this area are based on animal studies.
They are. And so the population studies, of course, are based on humans, and some of the brain science is based on animals. And there's a great study ongoing, just began actually in Boston, where they're studying monkeys, and they're going to give them in middle age all sorts of things, you know, blueberries, spinach, make them exercise, give them, you know, brain exercise. And they're going to watch these monkeys and say, okay, what is it that works best? You know, is it the red wine? Is it the spinach? And how can we keep those middle aged monkey brains going better?
Well, I like red wine. I like spinach, yeah. and I like blueberries.
You're all set. And here you are.
Is that it? But that would suggest that people who are having problems don't like those things. And
I'm sure
that's not always the case.
Not always the case. And the problem with food in our culture in particular is that, you know, we all, most of us eat, even if it's junk-filled food diet, we get most of the nutrients that we need. So it's hard to tweak it really with another bowl of blueberries. But they're hoping, and since our brain cells don't disappear, there's a lot of money behind this now. And I think that's, you know, you can tell that the scientists are taking this seriously when, you know, big drug companies buy little companies that are trying to put red wine into a pill.
Mm-hmm.
They're taking it fairly seriously.
I'd rather drink the glass with my meal.
Yes, 15,000, though. You have to drink 15,000.
But there is a genetic factor here as well.
Of course.
Some people just, they come from families where everybody's lived a long life and has remained sharp to the end.
Right. And certainly there's a familial trait that people have, but it doesn't always work in those families. We tend to look at the ones that, you know, most of us say, well, I had an uncle who lived to, you know, or my father lived to 95, so I'll be fine, you know, kind of.
And he smoked like a chimney.
Yeah, and we kind of ignore the people that drop dead at 50, so, you know, in our own family. So, you know, it's a little bit of optimistic science that we do ourselves. But certainly genetics is a component of this, and they're trying to sort that out, too. What it is in our genetics that helps brains, in some instances, repair themselves better. And that's really where they think the difference might be.
My guest is Barbara Strouch, the deputy science editor and health and medical science editor at the New York Times, author of The Primal Teen, What the New Discoveries About the Teenage Brain Tell Us About Our Kids, and now The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain, The Surprising Talents of the Middle-Aged Mind. It's published by Viking. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Barbara Strouch, whose latest book is The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain, The Surprising Talents of the Middle-Aged Mind, published by Viking. And I was wondering if you became interested in this topic in part because you were getting the sense that your brain was changing, or was this just the logical follow-up to your previous book on the teenage brain?
No, I mean, I just, I have a middle-aged brain, and I certainly had my middle-aged brain issues. You know, you go to the basement and get down to the bottom of the stairs, can't remember why you're there, and it is annoying and scary.
But, you know, when I think back to earlier times in my life, I had those experiences as well.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is that they seem scarier when you get older because you've been told that they could mean something else. And one of the things a lot of people are concerned about, obviously, is that when they start forgetting things, that Alzheimer's might very well be setting in. There's a big difference between forgetting where you put the keys or your glasses and Alzheimer's.
There is. Alzheimer's is a disease, and it certainly the risk of it increases as we age, but most of this sort of minor forgetting that we do is not a sign of Alzheimer's. You know, the classic one is, you know, you forget your keys or where they are, but if you forget what a key is for, then you're in more trouble. So I think many of us are panicked about this, but in many ways, this kind of minor forgetting is no big deal.
Now, do brain cells remain similar throughout a lifetime? What are they made of?
Well, they're the cells, the cell body, and then they have these branches that come out of them. The dendrites, and they have what's called an axon, which is a long tail that comes out the other end, and they don't actually stay exactly the same. There's a process, and this too is new about the middle-aged brain. There's a process called myelination, which is a coating. This is a layer of good fat, for once, and it coats the axons as they are used and pushed by genetics, but also by use. And they used to think this myelination, which actually makes the connection stronger, it makes the brain signals travel faster, 100 times faster on a myelinated axon than on a non-myelinated one.
Don't they also have to jump a gap at certain points?
Yes, that happens when the signals get to the other neuron and they go across a synapse, what it's called, and it turns into chemicals, actually. It turns from electrical signal into a chemical and actually ferries itself across to the other brain cell. But what we find is in middle age that this myelination process increases, and it peaks in middle age. And this was brand new, and it makes our brains, the connections, stronger.
The myelin is made out of glia cells.
Yes. Glia cells actually start the oligodendrocytes actually is what they produces it. And again, it's kind of fat that goes on the outside. It's like insulation, like for a wire on a laptop or a lamp.
Well, what role does myelin play in aging? Unlike neurons, we get more of it as we age. In a way where, you know, as our bellies are getting a little fatter, so
are
our brains.
Our brain cells, right. But this is apparently a good layer of fat. And they do find that, you know, when you're a child, the area of your brain where as your hands start getting more dexterous, you're myelinating that part of your brain. And so it actually makes the brain more work better in some ways. And certainly there's some declines of it in middle age, but there's a net gain. We're still producing myelin, and I think that was the surprise. And some people have suggested that this alone is what may account for what we think of as middle age wisdom.
Alice in Larchmont has written us. She left a comment on our show page. She said, I'm 58 and a professional musician, a flutist. I've just started classes in court reporting, which requires that you learn something that resembles a code related to the sounds of the words that people speak. I'm doing fine, but find it takes me a moment to process what keys I'm going to have to press and the phrases that can be written down in one stroke. In my hesitation due to my age, is it my hesitation due to my age or just because it's such a complex and new system I'm learning? And I want to extend that a bit. We do learn a lot more easily when we're young than we do when we're old. The line that you can't teach an old dog new tricks may very well have certain truth to it.
Well, I think it takes longer. I think they do find that on average that older brains take a little bit longer to learn new information, the latest computer system at work or whatever.
Or a language.
Or language can be harder. But that may come in part, there is a decline in processing speed, no question, from our 20s on. And this is the kind of thing they measure by, you know, how fast can you tap your finger or name things that begin with D. And so Alice has taken on a very difficult task, actually, for a middle-aged brain. Because of that speed that's necessary.
On the other hand, she's a flutist, so her fingers are more likely to be able to move with that kind of speed than some of the rest of us.
They're well myelinated, her finger part of her brain.
But even though it takes longer, we should try to continue to learn because it's good for us.
It is. We've all heard a lot of the cliches, you know, learn a new language or walk on the other side of the street. And what they do find is that if you really want to push your brain by middle age, you have to make it work really, really hard. We're now way beyond crossword puzzles. There are people at Columbia trying to teach people to use two parts of their brains, for instance, or more brain real estate, or go grab the frontal cortex and do things.
And I read recently that doing crossword puzzles really doesn't help keep the brain any sharper. This is really just a retrieval thing.
It is a retrieval thing of knowledge, you know. I mean, I can't think of anything bad about it, you know, but they really, if they want to, these days, if they tell you to do something for your brain, they want you to really push it. So that means, you know, whatever you're doing, make it new. One of my favorite things that I came across was the people who study adult learning say that you should actually, if you want your brain to develop as a grown-up, to talk to people who you disagree with. I mean, you know, it shakes up your assumptions. Your brain is set up to gather assumptions as it ages. And if we really want it to develop, what it's primed to do, actually, is to shake up those assumptions. And one way to do that is to, you know, confront things that make you a little uncomfortable.
Well, perhaps our country is moving in the opposite direction. Yes. It seems people are only talking to people they agree with.
Yeah, yeah. Well, right.
I fear for the elderly in the future.
Yeah.
you've mentioned a couple of times that we've changed our minds about the notion of midlife crisis and the empty nest syndrome.
Right.
How does that apply to brain development?
Well, I was interested in this because I think I sort of bought into this. I have two kids. They just left. I thought, well, empty nest is next, you know. And but when I actually looked into the science of it, it's based on almost, you know, zippity-doo-dah. This is very slim science, and it created an entire cultural narrative that is based on almost nothing. And when they do the actual, again, studies of real people in this modern middle age, thousands of people, they find that the sense of well-being actually increases in middle age and in peaks in some large studies at age 65.
People are actually happier, say they're happier when they're older?
They do. And
unless they have aches and pains.
Yeah. And I mean, in some ways it's counterintuitive. There's a lot of loss. You know, we watch parents die and friends get ill. So it doesn't make much sense. But there's a lot of work being done out at Stanford, for instance, where they actually look at a part of our brain called the amygdala. And that is a small part that's set up to respond to the negative, you know, and the scary person on the plane or talk to your boss, and this is the part that gets going. And they find that that part of the brain actually starts to respond less to the negative and more to the positive as we age, which I think is pretty amazing.
I would assume that from experience, we learn not to get ourselves into the kinds of messes we did when we were younger, although there are some people who seem to become more ornery as they get older.
Ornery is good. Yeah, maybe. I mean, a part of it is that we learn what to avoid, you know. I think, you know, middle age, we know things like it's very hard to measure, you know, the ability to keep your mouth shut. But I think that's a talent that we have sometimes if we're smart.
Is the middle-aged brain different for males and females?
There is a little bit of difference. They find, for instance, on younger ages, you know, there's a little bit more faster myelination of girls and boys, and they think that may explain, you know, why some girls are more socially organized than young boys. And by middle age, they do find that the men hold on to things they're traditionally good at a little bit longer, processing speed, spatial orientation, and the girls are good at verbal stuff.
We've been talking about loss of memory, but there's also memory improvement mm-hmm. in middle age, just memory.
Yes, and that's like if you want to memorize, you know, a list of fruits or a list of this or that, your brain at middle age might not be as good as it was in terms of how many you can remember. Medical school might be a little harder. But what we do get is the gist of an argument. We get those categories better. Oh, those are all fruit, or oh, those are all parts of the body, or on a simple level. And I think we know that too. You know, I have a friend who's a doctor in New York. She's in her 50s, and she says when she gets to a hospital room, she can immediately size up a situation. And that leaves a lot of room for her to come to a solution, and sometimes a creative one.
So we have gist memory. How many different kinds of memories, although gist does not sound very scientific to me,
yeah.
How many different kinds of memories are scientists talking about now?
Well, there's what's called episodic, and that's it's aligned really with the short-term memory. And episodic memory is one where, you know, you remember something in context. For instance, you know, did Harry come to Thanksgiving, for instance, or where was I for Thanksgiving? Or when you see somebody on the street, I think we all know this, they look familiar. We know them from somewhere. We just don't know the context. We don't know from where. And so that's episodic memory, and that can get a little bit fuzzy, too, as we age.
Why are memories among the first signs of memory loss? Why is it that we can't match a name to a face, but mm-hmm. have no difficulty matching other proper nouns to their objects?
Right. Well, there's a woman at Pomona College who studied this a lot, and she's talking about this tip of the tongue phenomenon, tots, she calls them, and they do increase with age. And this is the sense that we know somebody's name, but we just can't bring it to mind. And her research shows that there's really one connection between the sound of a name and the information about that name in the brain, and that can wane with disuse, with age. And many names, of course, as we know, are quite arbitrary. If we know we meet somebody on the street, we know that he's a baker, but we don't know his name is Bob. And mm-hmm. that's because baker has all sorts of different parts in our brain to hang out. You know, there's information about that baker, white hats or flour, that we can use to get to that.
Or if that person's name is an odder name, like
yes.
Napoleon, I may not remember the name, but I'll remember that
right.
it's a name that somehow has some historic significance.
Right, or Grumpy the Seventh Dwarf. I mean, names that have some, you know, some meaning to them is probably Grumpy may be easier to remember than Peter Pan.
So people who have problems remembering names sometimes just stop trying to remember, and then the name pops up. Do we know why?
Right. Well, there's some tricks, I think, that you were saying you even use, basically, to go through the alphabet. You know, you're standing in front of somebody or stuck in the elevator, and you think, A, Adam, B, Bob, and hope that that person doesn't really notice that
you're fumbling for a name.
You're fumbling for a name. And what Deborah Burke has found and others, that these names can pop up if you hear a similar sound that can kind of prime your brain. You know, she's done a wonderful study called, you know, Brad Pitt and Cherry Pitt, where if you're trying to remember Brad Pitt's name, which it's hard to believe, but anyway, and you can't bring it to mind. If someone later on says Cherry Pit to you, you'll think, oh, Brad Pitt. Or something a similar sound, like if you're trying to remember Velcro and someone later on says pellet to you, those even internal sounds will be enough to, and to us, I think we think it comes by magic or that we've just calmed down or something, but often there's something to prime that memory, and we might need a little bit more priming as we age.
My guest is Barbara Strauch. Her book, The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain, The Surprising Talents of the Middle-Aged Mind. You say that the brain starts using more of itself as it gets older. How does it learn to use both sides of itself?
Right.
Especially in males who, as I've always understood it, female brains are more integrated, left
right.
and right lobe, but male right. brains tend to be very specialized.
Right. Well, not by middle age. So what happens is when they first saw this, they saw with brains that were aging, they saw that they were using, say you needed to remember, there's a task like remember the word, learn the word piano, and then later on recall that word. And when you're young, one side of your brain would be used to learn the word and another side would be used to recall that word. And that's a distinct pattern they see in youth, in young brains. And when they started looking at old brains and could, they saw that the same thing, learning piano, remembering piano, they saw brains using two hemispheres, two sides. They call it bilateralization. And at first, it looked like this was a very bad thing. I mean, obviously, it does sort of portend some deficit somewhere, you know, if you need to use more of your brain than you used to. But as they looked at it further, they found that it was the brains that were the most cognitively astute that were learning to do this.
I would also assume that it would help if you had a stroke, because
yes.
if you have a stroke when you're younger,
right.
If it hits a certain part of the brain, then you may lose something forever. But
yes.
if the information is spread around.
Right, right. If you learn to use more real estate of your brain, they think that you might even build up what they call cognitive reserve, a kind of buffer that... you know, if you can think of a football field, if one part gets worn out, there's another part to use. And I think if we keep our brains alive, more parts of them alive, they do find that people who have higher education levels, for instance, can sometimes recover from stroke faster. So they might have brains that have been used in more active parts, more real estate actually used. So that may help them when they're confronting aging or even disease.
We're also living in a changing world. Has anyone looked into whether new trends in our culture, Google, iPhones,
right.
and such, are good or bad for the aging brain?
Well, I don't think they know yet. I think we're all confused by all this stuff. But on the other hand, it's also making our brains work hard. You know, computers make you think logically in a way to get from here to there. So I don't think it's all bad. I think the jury's out. We don't really know yet. I don't think there's any long-term studies yet on that kind of thing.
We mentioned earlier eating blueberries or mm-hmm. spinach, drinking red wine. What about some of the other things? What about the popular notion of the link between nutrients and the brain?
Nutrients, yes. Well, they used to think the blood-brain barrier, which exists, kept out nutrients, believe it or not. And now they know that's not true, that they do get through. So again, this has perked up the field, and they're looking for what it is that's the best nutrient to get in there. And we've all heard of antioxidants, I think. Those are the things that are in the fruits and vegetables of very high color. They're in tea. And, you know, even if you go to the grocery store, people will tell you, you know, eat more antioxidants for your brain. So they're trying to figure out, you know, can you eat more antioxidants or foods that have that in it and actually help the repair system of the brain. And that research is still ongoing, you know. It's hard to tweak something when our diet is rich already. So that's a problem. And also, we don't know which antioxidant would be good. You know, something like a thyme or a small thing has, you know, thousands of antioxidants. So, you know, the best advice, of course, is the old eat a varied diet.
Well, my parents used to, my mother anyway, used to tell me that fish was brain food.
Yes, fish was brain
food. It is brain food?
Well, that's the other part of this, is the omega-3s. And again, that's being studied very vigorously with the monkeys and things. And but brain food, you know, that is fights against inflammation. And we do know that inflammation can be a bad actor all over our body and also in the brain. So the idea of fish food is that, and fish oil, or if you want to go back further in the food chain, eat algae, because that's where the fish get their omega-3s to begin with. So you can just start with that anyway. So they are trying. They see it in animals. You know, beagles that are fed this kind of diet actually can learn tricks when they're older better than beagles that are not. And they're trying very hard to find it in humans. They don't know the dosage, you know. So, but they do know that inflammation and antioxidants are one of the repair systems in the brain, too, and we want to help those.
Well, what do antioxidants do?
Well, the brain, as it works, produces what's called a free radical, and this is kind of a weird molecule that goes around and actually damages the DNA in your brain, and there's a repair system set up in the brain for antioxidants to gobble up those free radicals and get rid of them, and so...
We're trying to jail all those radicals.
Yeah, jail the radicals. Get them right. So the idea is, can we pile more antioxidants into our bodies and into our brains and actually gobble up more free radicals? And that's the hope.
Are there foods that actually damage the brain?
Well, I think what we do know is that things like cardiovascular disease and stroke and things, diabetes, are very bad for the brain. So I think anything that... you know, helps us or pushes us toward those kinds of diseases would be bad for a brain. It's also known now and probably underappreciated, although we're getting a little bit this with the athletics, that it's not good to be hit in the head. you know, that
I
injury.
I kind of suspected that.
Yeah, I mean, you can, but right. So if you,
I always
wonder
about those detectives in the old novels who got, you know, were knocked out pretty much in every book,
right.
or on every radio
right.
show, a television show.
Right.
They probably had serious brain damage.
Well, I
they
think
could
we're
have
now,
had epilepsy.
Yeah, we're now appreciating that, you know, with, you know, from soccer players on, you know, football players, that there's that the brain, you know, can get hurt.
Can newly found appreciation for the middle-aged brain pose a problem for the way our society is set up?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think that we are, you know, we've just gone through this recession. We watched all these vibrant 60 and 70-year-old brains walk out the door. And I think that we have added 30 years to our lives, and we've put them all at the end and told people to do, go home and do nothing. So are we, you know...
Wear plaid trousers.
Yeah, right, exactly. And there's obviously a lot of complex leisure activities you can engage in. But I mean, I do think, and maybe this is wishful thinking, given that I have a middle-aged brain, but I do think that we should appreciate our middle-aged brains and have a little more respect.
Just one more thing. Size of brain has been totally discounted now.
The science of what?
Of our brains.
In what? What do you mean?
Are all brains pretty much the same size, or is,
oh,
is somebody smarter have a bigger brain?
Oh, that's, you know, it's, I think we don't know that. You know, female brains are a little bit smaller than males, and so there's always been this
well, that proves it
problem
lot,
out there. But, you know, they do say that female brains may be more efficient. You know, Einstein had a lot of glial cells in his logic area, but they were packed in there tight. Did it make his brain bigger? You know, there have been some correlations with IQ and brain size, but mostly I think they can't tell.
Barbara Strauch's book, her latest, The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain, The Surprising Talents of the Middle-Aged Mind, is published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you for having me.